for Monday, June 24th, 2013. Who's here? Should we do first?
Is anybody here for the SCR?
Not yet. I think we're supposed to be here.
Oh, he was starting not to come.
Oh. Well, nobody else is here then, but maybe we start with Senate Bill 150 and go back.
You want to do SCR 19?
Courtney might be coming.
Oh, Courtney might be coming?
Yeah.
So why don't we open a public hearing on Senate Bill 150 since the Secretary of State's office is here, ready to testify. Gina Zedlick, please.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 150 increases maximum appeal penalty for violation of election law or rule from $250 to $1,000, eliminates requirement that certain ballots be printed in different colors, increases time allowed for mailing of ballots from 18 to 20 days before the date of an election. There is no revenue, no or minimal fiscal impact. It came to you with 21 I-votes in the Senate.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Gina Zedlick from the Secretary of State's office. And Aaron just about summed up the three, there are three distinct aspects in Senate Bill 150 that are included in the summary that the committee administrator just gave. And I'll just elaborate a little bit on each of them to sort of say why and explain them a little bit. Section 1 deals with the color of ballots for a primary election. And this is one of those types of laws that made a lot more sense when we had polling places and they printed Republican ballots and Democratic ballots in different colors. Today we have specifically marked ballot styles, and so some counties may, by removing the language, we remove the requirement that these ballots be printed in different colors. I know a number of counties will continue to print in different colors, but for some counties it's a big cost savings for them, so we would like to remove that mandatory language. In Section 2, we raise the maximum civil penalty for general violations of election laws or rules from $250 to up to $1,000. This is a discretionary maximum that would be in place. The most important thing here is that it applies to all election laws or rules that don't otherwise have a specific penalty attached. So it's the catch-all. So if you pass a new election law tomorrow and you don't put a penalty on it, this is what covers you and allows for some enforcement. I have examples of things that this might cover today, but and also for us it aligns with, we have a $1,000 kind of maximum civil penalties across the board for different violations, so this allows for a lot more consistency from the Secretary of State's perspective. Finally, the bill was amended to allow ballots to be sent 2 days earlier. So instead of 18 days before an election, it would go to 20 days. This is because of the closure of three mail centers in the state, specifically Bend, Pendleton, and Salem. So now ballots that used to be able to be processed locally now have to go through Portland or Medford. Even if they're mailed within the same city, they have to bounce back and forth. So we wanted to just to make sure that ballots got to people within so they have enough time to vote and get their ballots returned. That's to accommodate that. And we anticipate more closure of mail centers in 2014. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Sedlick? Representative Berger.
Hi, Gina.
Hi.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Give me an example of what you would fine 250 for now that you're now authorized to go up to, if you can, up to 1,000 on.
Thank you, Chair Garrett and Senator Berger. I've made a note of a few. I'll just read them if that's okay. Unlawful electioneering would be one that you could only charge 150 or 250 for today. Betting or placing a wager on an election by a candidate or person. And then there's a bunch related to voting in, like making a false statement about marking a ballot, obstructing the entrance of a building in which ballots are issued, willfully leaving evidence showing how a ballot was marked, outside the ballot, for example, removing ballots from designated places, destruction of election equipment, establishing unofficial drop sites out of compliance with the law.
Are there others? Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Is that the example you're giving, but are there others?
I'm sure there are others. It's right now we have, there are a lot of, most of the ones that are, that people think about most commonly have very specific violations listed. They're either subject to criminal penalty or to up to $10,000. So this is the catch-all, and I just went through and looked for things today. So those are some of the ones. I'm sure there are more.
Just a comment. Up to $1,000 is a lot for minor, you know, violations. I understand the convenience factor, but I'm a little uncomfortable with it. The other parts of the bill I'm probably pretty comfortable with, but this part I frankly think there's a reason for minor violations, and this basically, and you would by rule then go through and say, or if a new one crops up you never heard of, you decide. Is that
right? Representative Berger, I don't, this doesn't reflect an intention to be you know, more punitive of mistakes or things that people do unintentionally. I think you're right. It would also be in rule that we specify on the what we call the penalty matrix, I believe. So it would be in there and it would be factored in, but it's not supposed to be. It is, I mean, on one hand, it does make $250 to some people is not that big of a deal. And not that 1,000 might be, but it gives it a little bit more leeway.
How long has the maximum been at 250?
Chair Garrett.
A long time?
A long time. I don't know.
Any other questions? Representative Kettler?
Well, Wally was next.
Oh, sorry. Didn't see you. Go ahead.
What is establishing an unofficial drop site? What is that?
Chair Garrett, Representative Hicks. Right now, there are rules about how to establish an unofficial drop site. They're outlined in statute. The penalty would be if you didn't comply. Like, you have to, I think, what all I'm remembering off the top of my head is that you have to label it unofficial. Huh. So if you didn't and you made it seem like it was official, this would be a penalty that could be applied. So, yeah.
And how does collecting another person's ballot in order to transport it to an official drop site or an unofficial one that's established pursuant to rule fit into the scheme of election law? I mean, someone goes to a home, picks up a ballot, says, I'm going to take it to a drop site for you. Is that allowed or not? And if so, are there implications for that in terms of this fee or this going up, penalty going up?
Chair Garrett, Vice Chair Hicks, I believe that is allowed right now.
And so
that is lawful.
Which, so that would not be, that kind of conduct that I've just described there would, you think, this is off the cuff, I know, but you're thinking at this point, likely not be implicated in the increase of this fine.
Chair Garrett, Vice Chair Hicks, no. Right now that is lawful, that someone else can turn in your ballot for you if you give your ballot to someone else. So, no, okay. That would not be.
Thank you.
Representative Kenemer?
No.
Okay. Did you have a question? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 150. We are going to carry over the work session probably until tomorrow, as we will with all the bills on today's agenda. So, let's open a public hearing on SCR 19.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 19 honors Richmond Elementary School on its 100th anniversary. And I do not believe there's anybody signed up to testify on the SCR.
Representative Berger, would you like to
lead
the way on this?
I don't think I need to go down there to say that as a former member of the Salem-Keizer School District, I deeply appreciate that Richmond Elementary School has had a fine history. It is years ago when I was involved in building a bond. It was one of the schools that was old, but was a hugely important anchor for the Richmond community, and we fixed it up instead of letting it go, and with good reason, because I think this is the kind of school that is valuable and important in a community, and I'm kind of proud of its 100-year history. So Just so you understand how it fits, it has been traditionally a school that is highly impacted, at least in recent years, by issues of poverty, and yet it has rallied to have a good standards and a staff that's been dedicated and has done really good work for its students. So that's Richmond in a short and sweet.
Thank you very much. Any further comments during our public hearing? Close the public hearing on SCR 19. Open a work session at SCR 19.
Mr. Chair, I move SCR 19 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves SCR 19 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. Representative Berger, would you like to carry it?
I think Representative Clem would probably like to. It's in his district.
Okay.
Very well. Thank you.
But I'll be happy to if he does.
Representative Clem will carry it. Close the work session on SCR 19. Ready on the floor.
Because Senator Starr and Senator Beyer are both here to testify.
They're here.
They've stepped outside to go to the House Senate rolls.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 844.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, Senate Bill 844 directs Public Utility Commission to establish a voluntary program to create incentives for public utilities that furnish natural gas to invest in projects that reduce emissions and provide benefits to consumers. Requires final orders issued by commission under measure to specify type of ratepayer from which whom utility may recover costs incurred in investments made. Specifies eligibility criteria and process for implementation of incentive program. This measure comes to you from the Senate floor. With 29 aye votes, one member was excused. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the measure.
Okay, Senators Beyer and Starr are here or around here. Okay, we'll wait. Thank you. Yeah. Welcome, colleagues.
Ready?
Ready when you are.
Okay, so you're up on 844, I hope.
That's the one.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Lee Beyer. I have the pleasure of representing the good people of Central Lynn and Lane Counties in the State Senate and chaired the Transportation and Business Committee, which this bill originated in, came out of. In fact, we put it together in the interim. The bill was intended to sort of do the reverse of what the legislature has done over the last half a decade or so in terms of addressing climate issues and renewable energy, where in the past we have mandated, the legislature has mandated what utilities and participating parties had to do. And as we discussed, we thought, well, we've got a goal of reducing carbon and addressing these things. How about if we do it the other way? Let's turn to the industry and say, you guys are the experts on this. We'll create a mechanism where you can work with the Public Utility Commission in a voluntary, unquote, voluntary way. You propose a project, demonstrate that it works and has a benefit to your customers, and then the commission, under certain conditions, can approve that. When we originally started this, we were a little broader in terms of looking at all utilities. It was clear that there were some concerns on the electrical side because they had been doing a lot of things with renewable portfolio standards and other things that address that, less so on the natural gas side. So this one, as we got into it, it's sort of a sense of convenience. There was real interest on the part of the natural gas industry to explore this option, see if it made sense for them and their customers. And to a large extent on the customer base, there was interest for them to do this as well. So what you have before you now is a fairly limited bill that provides natural gas companies the opportunity to work with their customers and the their regulator, the Public Utility Commission, to propose projects and seek recovery on those costs in a way to get at some of these. One of the things, I know there are some who have some concerns about this, and the natural concerns are the impact of rates and whether it benefits them, you know, particular customers or not. And I would note that the bill is fairly clear on this. It provides the direction to the Public Utility Commission on how to do this. And
the utilities have to provide a project plan, if you will, that describes exactly what the benefit is going to be to the customers, how they're going to limit rate impact, and how that rate impact will be limited to customers who derive a direct benefit from the project. So I think it's a good one. The best illustration of this that I can come up with, I think, and what excites me is we've talked a lot about how do you get at the vehicle fleet. It's no surprise to anyone now that gasoline and diesel prices are sky high, and they gyrate as much as, you know, 50 cents up or down in about a three-week period of time. There's very little limiting on that. As we looked at that, if you look at the cost of using compressed natural gas for fuel stock for either trucks or cars, it's about 40% of the cost of retail gasoline or diesel. So there's an incentive to do this, but we have a bit of a chicken and egg situation. It's hard for particularly industry, the commercial fleet, or others to get into the business of making a commitment to fuel switching if there's not an infrastructure there. So you sort of have that chicken and egg, which do you build first? This is intended to provide the opportunity, and I don't know whether it'll happen or not, although, as I said, we have some interest of creating the infrastructure to allow something like that to happen. That has the potential for a downward price pressure, not only on those directly using natural gas as a fuel, but also as you switch there, you put more competition into the stream, the fuel stream for the other prices. So I think it has some unique opportunities. It's not just in vehicles, but that'd be a primary beneficiary of that. So that's what we were trying to do. Again, I want to close by emphasizing this is a voluntary program, and it requires their regulator, the Public Utility Commission, to hold public hearings on any proposal, and they have to demonstrate that there is a clear benefit statement there, if you will. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Starr.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Senator Bruce Starr. I have the distinct privilege of representing Western Washington County in the Oregon Senate. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 844. As you heard, Senator Beyer kind of outlined the program. I really appreciate Senator Beyer taking the leadership on this and having the work group and introducing the legislation. However, as we got into the midst of this legislative session, the bill as it was originally introduced had generated significant opposition. Significant to the point that it created a problem for passage. So I appreciate Senator Beyer allowing me to work collaboratively with a number of the stakeholders to address some of those concerns and come up with a bill that, as we sit here today, passed the Oregon Senate unanimously. We eliminated really the opposition to the bill by narrowing it to natural gas only. You'll hear from testimony, I believe, post when we get up from here of an interest group that's very interested in moving forward with natural gas. And that's really what we're here to talk about. As you know, the drive to move toward alternative fuels, I think, is important. As I look at it, it's about fuel security. It's about developing a North American asset that we have. We don't have to go offshore in order to bring fuel to our shores. There's an emissions reduction that's evident in this program as well. And also, at the end of the day, I believe there's going to be savings to the users as we allow this program to go forward. So for those reasons, I'm pleased to be here in support of the engrossed version of Senate Bill 844, and I would ask for your support so that we can allow this program to advance. Thank you.
Thank you both. Any questions for our senators? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions that come quickly to mind. First off, my elementary courses in economics, you used to talk about something about supply and demand. The net effect of the success of this bill and this effort would be to increase the demand for natural gas. The logical consequence is that the price of natural gas is going to go up, And for those of us who are not running freightliners up and down the freeway, but using natural gas to heat our house, how are you going to control the natural, what I think will be a natural consequence of this bill, seeing a significant rise in the price of natural gas for home heating?
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, you're right. There is an impact that goes on there, but the other side of that one is during my just slight of a decade serving the PUC, I watched natural gas prices go from roughly $1.50, $2 a British thermal unit to as high as $15, $16, and now it's back under $3 for the most part, largely because of the supply. What's changed the face of that was the fact that new exploration and extraction techniques have come on called fracking. The current supply in the United States, according to industry experts, on usage is probably somewhere between 300 and 500 years. And in fact, they're closing in wells now because we're, if you will, awash in natural gas. So I think the at least the immediate term, while we're, you know, some have called natural gas a transition or fuel to get to something better, if you will. I don't think there's any doubt that you would have some upward price, but I don't think significantly, certainly not to the extent that customers experienced in the first decade of this century.
Follow-up question?
I'm vaguely aware of the projections on the amount of natural gas we have, and also aware that there's probably a lot of areas where natural gas might be available that haven't even been looked at yet, so don't even enter into that formula or equation. However, going back to homeowner from Pendleton, Oregon here, as I've gone through this cycle where you were sitting on the PUC and the natural gas was rising and falling, at very rapid rates, the thing that I noticed was that my the heating of my house remained constant regardless of that it did in fact go up with the increasing cost of natural gas, but when gas dropped to $3, it didn't go down. Now, being the pessimist that I am, I'm somewhat inclined to worry about this additional demand and the long-range consequence of it, then that's not a question that needs to be answered, but an observation.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think if you looked at the rates, and I would note that for my 9 years plus on the commission, I only seen it go one way. But after I left, it seemed to have dropped considerably. And I noticed this as a residential user of natural gas as a heating source. I've seen it drop. The rates have dropped substantially since then. The retail, not as much as I'd like to see them drop, but they're down.
Yeah. Further questions? Thank you, colleagues.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you being here. We have three other witnesses: Margie Hoffman, Bruce Anderson, Bob Russell.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Margie Hoffman. I'm Governor Kitzhaber's Energy Policy Advisor, and just want to thank you for hearing Senate Bill 844 today and encourage you to pass the bill out of committee to the floor. As the senators have mentioned, we work very closely with a broad group of stakeholders to put together Senate Bill 844, and we believe that it represents a good pilot program that will allow natural gas utilities that want to work with their industrial customers to bring forward energy efficiency and conservation programs and also alternative fuels projects that will help not only reduce reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the state of Oregon, but will also help lower the cost that people are currently paying on their utility or fuels bill. I want to clarify one thing that we did amend and add in Section 8A, which says that if you are the beneficiary of the greenhouse gas reduction program, then you pay for the greenhouse gas reduction program. So this is not a bill that would enable an industrial customer to do an industrial energy efficiency project, for example, or a transportation fueling station, for example, and rate base that across all ratepayers. If you are the beneficiary of the project, then you will pay for the project. So thank you very much, and I urge your aye vote.
Thank you, Margie. Bruce.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Bruce Anderson, representing Northwest Natural. Appearing today in support of Senate Bill 844. Want to just echo some of the things that Ms. Hoffman iterated here in her testimony. Northwest Natural buys natural gas, which is a fossil fuel, and distributes it to approximately 670,000 customers in Oregon and southwestern Washington. As we look to the future, we believe there will be requirements either directly or indirectly to reduce greenhouse gases. We buy natural gas and sell it to our customers, and the only thing we add is an odorant called mercaptan that makes it smell like rotten eggs. Natural gas utility, unlike an electric utility, is somewhat limited in how we can reduce greenhouse gases. So we simply can't shift over to wind or wave or solar voltaic energy and put that into our pipes. We're working with producers to make sure their systems are as tight as possible, and we are doing the same on our system. Senate Bill 844 would allow us to identify programs that would give us some additional options. While we haven't determined what those would be at this point, they could include obtaining biogas from landfills, wastewater treatment plants, or from dairy and cattle operations, and either cleaning it up to pipeline quality standards, making it available to use in the vehicle transportation sector, or for use on site. In addition, we can work with our customers to use natural gas in the most efficient and environmentally manner possible in the areas of providing compressed natural gas, CNG, or liquefied natural gas for transportation purposes. We could also work with customers on combined heat and power projects, helping our customers burn natural gas as efficiently as possible and capture the waste heat for other uses. SB 844 is voluntary. Utilities are not mandated to do any projects or to meet a specific overall goal. The utility is required to demonstrate that it worked with its customers before it brings a project to the PUC for consideration. We believe this is very important and a key to determining whether any project will go forward. Each project must benefit customers, and has been stated earlier, the Senate amended the bill in subsection 8A to state that the customers that benefit from a program would be the ones that would pay for it, and the PUC will set an overall rate cap for each utility to make sure that this overall concept does not negatively impact customers. And we believe that this would be have more customer benefits than a carbon tax, which some legislators have been proposing, I believe. For these reasons, we believe it's worth giving the program a try. In the end, the utilities, customers, interest groups, and PUC may decide that none or only a couple of programs merit going forward. But we should learn more about the ways we can meet our customers' demand for energy and the increasing regulations around greenhouse gases. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Russell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I, too, am here in support of Senate Bill 844. And the trucking industry has been working hard over the last decade or so to reduce emissions from heavy trucks. We've reduced particulate matter emissions and NOx by about 95%. But we've taken the technology about as far as it can go, and we're still very much a diesel-based industry. That's a carbon-based fuel, and in order for us to reduce carbon, we are either going to have to switch fuels or develop new technologies. We've been working with Daimler Freightliner and Oregon State University to create a partnership between those two entities to develop the 2050 no-emissions truck for the future. That's the technology piece. But we need a way to get from where we are today to that 2050 truck, and we see natural gas as being the bridge for us to the future. The reason we're excited about this bill is it has the potential of helping us develop a natural gas fueling station network so that we can fuel our trucks around the state and start making the switch to natural gas. As has been mentioned a number of times, this is a voluntary program, and it will be paid for by the people that benefit. So in our case, if we were to enter into a partnership with Northwest Natural with approval of the PUC to do a natural gas fueling station, they would simply increase the cost of that natural gas that goes through that fueling station that we purchase to pay for the fueling station. So no other customers of Northwest Natural would be impacted by this program. So we think this is the next logical step for the trucking industry, and support the bill and hope that you will too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Holby.
I was wondering if you could clarify the section you were talking about. I guess that's subsection 8A that was added into exactly how is the commission going to establish whether or not a ratepayer benefits from the project? I mean, if it's a, you know, emission reduction program, seems like everybody benefits in some sense. So what does that mean, benefit?
Chair Garrett, Representative Holvey, thank you for your question. The beneficiary of the, so everybody does benefit from the cleaning up our air, from creating healthier air and reducing particulate emissions, NOx, SOx, and greenhouse gases in our air. But when we talk about the beneficiary of the project, that would be, for example, if there were three private sector fleets that were the beneficiary or the user of a fueling station, then they would pay for the fueling station with a special tariff, and that would be determined by the Public Utility Commission.
Thanks.
So residential customers wouldn't pick up the tab for a fueling station that's utilized by private fleets.
Further questions?
Just clarification. So if the fueling station was served the public, then that beneficiary would be spread out, I would assume, to all those ratepayers.
Chair Garrett, Representative Holvey, absolutely. So one of the things that we want to look at as we build out an alternative fuel infrastructure is to have that infrastructure built in a way where multiple fleets from different companies or from the public sector can fuel at that station. So that could look in any function in any number of ways. The more end users that you have converting their trucks and benefiting from natural gas fueling stations, the less expensive it will be for any one particular fleet to pay back the cost of installation of the station.
Thank you. Further questions? Apparently not. Thank you. Panel.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 844. Earlier I said we'd be carrying over the work session, but we actually do have the ability to move this today, so I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 844.
Chair Garrett, I move Senate Bill 844 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves Senate Bill 844 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. And we should carry. I'm going to ask Representative Bailey to carry the bill. He likes this stuff. I'm going to close the, work session on...
Is that a compliment, sir?
Well, that'll give us something to do next week.
Representative Reed, you're the sponsor.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 844. And I'm now going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 414.
Hi, Paul. This is Erin Seiler calling from the House Committee on Rules. We are just going to start the public hearing on Senate Bill 414, if you want to hang on for 1 second.
Thank you. I'm ready.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 414 allows Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services to seek restitution and other equitable relief on behalf of consumer for actual damages consumer suffers as a result of insurer's violation of insurance code, breach of contract or policy, or violation of applicable federal law. Clarifies action by director is regulatory and does not create cause of action for any other person. There is an emergency clause on this measure. There's no revenue, no fiscal impact, and it comes to you from the Senate floor with 19 aye votes, 10 noes, and one member was excused.
So we have Mr. Turtle on the phone, and Lou Savage will be testifying. Paul, why don't we have you go ahead?
Thank you. Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Paul Turtle, and I'm the resident of Northwest Portland in House District 36. I am speaking today as a consumer of the insurance industry and as a volunteer advocate. Over the last couple of years, I have helped close to 100 families with insurance-related issues and appeals, primarily related to health insurance for treatment of autism. And I, in working either directly through insurance industry appeals processes and with the insurance division, in many cases we've been extremely successful. We have won more than 20 external review appeals overturning denials of medically necessary evidence-based care for autism, and it's really been extremely helpful when we've been able to get the process to work. What we have found, though, is that when we really have tough issues where we simply have a disagreement with an insurer over contract or over administrative application of the insurance code, that we really haven't had a good way of resolving that. When we work with the insurance division, what we have found is they can be very helpful. Sometimes they'll even tell us, you know what, I think they're violating your contract here. Or I think that you may want to hire a lawyer to take a look at this one. And we basically found that the insurance division, they're helpful, but ultimately when it comes to actually compelling an insurer to pay a claim if they feel that is justified, they simply don't have that authority right now. And so the purpose behind Senate Bill 414 is basically to strengthen the existing processes that we already have, so that if we have a case where an insurance company is not in compliance with a contract or is not following the insurance code, and the insurance division is supporting the consumer on that, this would allow the insurance division to help out the consumer and basically go and press the insurance company to actually pay that claim. I would not look at this as a substitute for a private right of action. It's House Bill 3160 would do. It's a separate process that I think is also very important to basically strengthen the existing administrative processes and hopefully resolve a lot of these cases without ever any need to seek a judicial solution. I think this would really help a lot of the cases that I have worked with, a lot of the families that I've worked with, and I would really encourage you to support this bill. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Savage and then take questions at the end.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Garrett, Vice Chair Hoyle, and Hicks, Lou Savage from the Insurance Division. Senate Bill 414 is not our bill, but we do think that it would add a great tool to the insurance division toolbox. We have a strong insurance code. It prohibits misrepresentation of facts on the policy language. It prohibits false and deceptive and misleading statements. It contains prohibitions under the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act. And we have some tools. We have the authority to assess civil penalties. We can examine records. We have the authority to approve policy forms and review insurance rates for health insurance. And what we don't have is the authority to order restitution. And the reason that can be important for consumers is that it actually is the authority to put cash back into a consumer's pocket who has been damaged by an insurance company. So for that reason, we think it's an important tool in the toolbox. The way the bill is written, It gives the division the authority to order restitution, but it is couched in the may language. So it's discretionary on the part of, as this language is, the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which the insurance division is part of. So it is, again, it's discretionary. It would be an important tool, and particularly for claims which are small enough that a consumer has really been damaged, but possibly not large enough for an attorney to take the case. And it would be relatively quick. There's a due process element for the insurer. They could ask for a hearing if the division decides to assess a penalty, and it would be resolved, again, in certainly a much shorter period of time than litigation would be if that was the only alternative. Be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. On page 2, lines 1 through 3, particularly line 3, this does not create a cause of action for any other person. So in the event that a consumer is dissatisfied with the department's handling of or lack of handling of their perceived restitution claim, is there a recourse remedy? What happens then if the department does not seek restitution on behalf of a consumer who happens to disagree and feel that restitution is warranted in the case for either witness?
Chair, I'll take a shot at it, and you can jump into.
Please go ahead.
Chair Garrett, Vice Chair Hicks. I don't think this language takes away any remedy that a consumer has now. For example, we often get calls from a consumer who has had a claim denied, health insurance, for example. They call our consumer advocates. They believe that the claim is covered under their policy. We do an analysis. And if we believe that, in fact, the consumer is entitled to have that claim covered, we contact the company, and we hope urge them to cover the claim, and that often it happens. But there are circumstances under which we look at the policy, we hear what the consumer has to say, and we tell the consumer, I'm sorry, you know, we just don't think that claim is covered under your policy. Currently, they would have the right to sue us. In the 10-year, I believe it's a discretionary act on our part, on the part of the division. So there's that law, that discretionary act concept. But in addition to that, just practically, in the 10 years that I've worked for the department, we have never had a consumer who's been dissatisfied with our decision suing the department.
Oh.
I guess. I mean, and indeed, but this is going to statutorily, I think, prohibit a cause of action based upon dissatisfaction of this particular decision by the department.
Chair Garrett, Vice Chair Hicks, we could have a lawyer's argument here. I think the language that says it does not create a cause of action, I don't think that means it takes away any existing cause of action. I believe what this language was for, and I think was an amendment actually, was to address the issue of whether this creates an additional private right of action over and above what currently exists in the law. The bill that they created an additional right under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which I know was debated both in the House and in the Senate. There was some concern that giving the division the authority to order restitution somehow would a private party would be able to bootstrap a cause of action just because of the authority to order restitution. So I think this language just says you don't get anything more than what you already have, but I don't think it prohibits anything that would exist under current law.
Ms. Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in this restitution that could be ordered under this bill by DCBS, do the actual damages include attorney fees for the consumer?
Chair Garrett, Representative Holvey, the division would be acting on its own. We would not ask for attorney's fees. If the insurer asks for a hearing under the Administrative Procedures Act, and we had to involve the Department of Justice, it would be a contested case hearing, and we had to involve the Department of Justice, then I think the Department of Justice could ask for attorney fees, but it would be under very limited circumstances. But the consumer would not need to hire a private attorney to be able to seek restitution. They would work with the division to get that remedy.
Just listening to the testimony and some experience I've had with consumers around insurance policies, it seems like they usually do need to go to an attorney to figure out where their legal status is, and so that's why I was asking. If a consumer comes to you, or an attorney on behalf of a consumer comes to you to try to seek restitution, those attorney fees, if a consumer uses an attorney, then wouldn't be paid for through your restitution, is I think what I'm hearing you say.
Chair Garrett, Representative Holvey, I think the reason that this bill is before you right now, and Paul Turdall can speak to this, is that consumers are frustrated that they have to hire a lawyer in order to get this kind of restitution. I think our history is that when we are given the authority that we need, we are actually very effective in getting the remedy that consumers need. So a consumer could avoid coming to the department just like they can today. If they decided that they wanted to hire a lawyer on their own and not go through the department, they could certainly do that. But they wouldn't need to if they came to the division.
Follow up.
Chair Holvey, Chair Garrett, if I may follow up on that.
Please, go ahead.
As Commissioner Savage mentioned, a lot of my own idea for this would be to resolve at least some of the simple cases quickly without any need for an attorney. I personally do not see this as a substitute for a private right of action bill such as House Bill 3160. I look at it as a complement, and I think there's a role for both of those kinds of things. The kinds of things that brought this one up were cases where we filed consumer complaints with the insurance division. We heard feedback from the insurance division that they thought that we were probably right, and yet they did not have any ability to actually get a claim. In one of those cases, the consumer got a letter back politely suggesting they seek legal counsel. In another case, the dollar value wasn't high enough to warrant that, and it basically just got dropped. And the goal here really is for those cases that you just want to get that are relatively clear cut, where the consumer has the insurance division's support, and just giving the insurance division the power to act, but not taking away from or substituting for a much more complicated case where you really wouldn't need an attorney to pursue a major case.
Follow-up question.
A follow-up to that. I appreciate your comments, but I'm assuming that you're an attorney, and that you're, or not, but you're talking about bringing these claims forward for people. So who's paying you to do that?
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, I am actually not an attorney. I'm just an ordinary consumer who has been, working with his own family's claims, and just by through friends and networking, just purely as a volunteer helping other people through the process. It is definitely a hard process. I've been doing everything purely as a volunteer and just for the sake of helping people, and I'm thrilled by the amount of progress that we have been able to make. But I'm very much focused on getting results for consumers.
follow-up question?
Follow-up, maybe on a different line. I appreciate that that this is so complex. They need help from people to get through it, but not an attorney. The next question I have is really around the what's currently available to the consumer. When you say that this doesn't create a cause of action, they have any cause of action they currently have under law, which I believe they can sue for breach of contract. But how do the attorney fees work in that part of law where a consumer would find that the restitution wasn't ample or did not agree with the DCBS determination under this and decided that they wanted to sue under the breach of contract with the insurer? How do the attorney fees work in that situation?
Chair Garrett, Representative Holsey, members of the committee, I am probably the perfect example of that question. I have an individual plan for my family, and that means that I don't have protection from federal law like ERISA as somebody who gets their insurance through an employer would. My own contract with my insurer has a clause in it stating that there is no possible recovery of attorney fees. So in one of these cases, I did actually consult with an attorney about possibly pursuing litigation, and the net was for what would have amounted to about $20,000 in recovery, which is certainly a significant amount. I could have been looking at $50,000 to $70,000 in attorney's fees that would never have been recovered even if I had been successful. As a practical matter, that's a theoretical private right of action, but it's not a practical one, and that's why I'm hoping that we can get something like House Bill 3160 separately so that there is a meaningful private right of action where you can get a reasonable recovery of attorney's fees. Senate Bill 414 is different. This is really focused on purely administrative processes to basically strengthen the ability of the insurance division to take action. I would not look at it as a substitute for the private right of action, and whether we do it in this session or another session, I'm certainly hoping we can do something to strengthen the right of consumers to take action on their own where that's necessary.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. Lou, here's my question. Under the provisions of this, if someone should come and say, we seek restitution from you against our insurance company, and it may be a de minimis amount, nothing is de minimis to somebody, okay? and the director of DCBS then would go to a hearings process. What would be the next step? Would he investigate personally? What would be the next thing that would happen under that?
Chair Garrett, Representative Berger, we would handle it as we do other enforcement cases. It would be it probably would come in through the consumer advocacy hotline that we have. It would be assigned to an investigator, and then we have an enforcement officer who works with the investigator, and we would ultimately make a decision as to whether to pursue it. Likely, we would have already made contact with the insurance company even before we got that far. So what happens now is we get a phone call, the consumer advocate takes the information, makes a decision based on the facts, and then contacts the insurance company to get their side of the story. Yeah.
Well, can I pursue this, Mr.
Follow-up
Chair?
Question.
So this all happens outside of the language of this bill already?
Yes.
So this bill doesn't change any of that problem?
No.
Okay?
No.
So what does this bill change?
This bill changes the ability of the insurance division to actually say to the insurer, and I'll give you an example, to say to the insurer, there is money that you have that belongs to the consumer, pay it back to them.
Okay, so here's my question.
Follow up.
Thank you. If you determine that you don't really think restitution is owed, or you think it's $1,000 and the consumer thinks it's $2,000, does that consumer, can then they sue you for not getting as much restitution as they wanted? That's the critical question I was trying to get at in our brief conversation.
So, Chair Garrett, Representative Berger, when I was having this discussion with Representative Hicks, it's really the same issue that we have today, and that is that we every day tell consumers that the claim that you think you have actually does not exist. Now, this is an additional remedy that the consumers have, and theoretically, a consumer could sue us today for a decision that we make not to go forward on a complaint that they have.
So this language, Mr. Chair, does not change that. I guess that's what I was looking to absolutely establish, what other thing that we're not causing any kind of a added
exposure.
Exposure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Hicks.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Kennemer.
Maybe more comment. It just seems to me this is a pretty quick and simple potential remedy for families that are usually typically stressed out and not in a very good position to negotiate with someone. So I really like the bill.
Thank you. Representative Hicks.
And so there is no expenditure impact. Who does pay for this? Who does pay for your action?
Vice Chair Hicks, we currently have an enforcement unit. We have the capacity to handle more cases because we will just prioritize the most important cases. We will eventually get to all of them as we have done. So there is an existing unit that handles this. And we assess penalties when required, and we have on our website, you know, we list the penalties that we assess against both carriers and producers. So the structure and the function exists today. The only thing we're really doing is adding an additional remedy for consumers. I will tell you that on Friday, we got a call from one of the members of this body. One of their constituents had been with one insurance company. It was an automatic withdrawal from her account. She changed companies and notified the first carrier that she was changing companies. The carrier continued to withdraw funds. And according to the consumer, we haven't checked this out yet, according to the consumer, the carrier is refusing to refund the money. And that's a really good example of a place where we could just order restitution. And the constituent wouldn't have to go to court. If the carrier disputed our findings, our proposed order, they could ask for a contested case hearing, and it would be over relatively quickly.
Further discussion? Mr. Trudolph, thank you very much for joining us. Mr. Savage, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 414. And this one we will be carrying over in the work session until at least tomorrow. So, no further business. Committee's adjourned.